The next case on the court's calendar is Jose Asesina v. State, case number 74071.
Justice Stiglitz, Judges, Justice Silver, Justice Hardesty, my name is David Westbrook, and may it please the court, I'm here to represent Jose Asesina. With me at council table are Deborah Westbrook and Carly Kearney, also from the Public Defender's Office. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. A trial judge is charged with providing order and decorum in trial proceedings, but in this case, the judge injected chaos, vitriol, and bias. It started in voir dire with the court's outrageous attack on juror number 177, and it continued through deliberations with the court's coercive and, in this case, unconstitutional Allen charge. Mr. Asesina was denied a fair trial, and the only recourse is reversal for a new trial. Now, I know the court has seen the video that we submitted. We thank you for allowing that video to be submitted, so I'm not going to give you 1,000 more words to describe that picture. But what happened on that video with the attack, the verbal attack on juror number 177, was unjustifiable. In their brief, which I will note that Mr. Hammer did not write, in their brief, the state tried to justify that with miscitations to the record and misrepresentations. But there simply is no justification. What happened should not have happened. There's no question that it prejudiced the jury. This is structural error that requires reversal. The result of doing what this judge did during voir dire was to unreasonably restrict voir dire and interfere with the right to a fair and impartial jury under Salazar and McNally and NRS 175.031. It interfered with our ability to ferret out bias because nobody was brave enough to speak up on bias after juror 177 was attacked. The judge literally threatened repercussions for anyone he perceived was trying to get out of service. And everybody in that courtroom who'd been paying attention realized, had to have realized, that this juror wasn't trying to get out of service. This juror was simply honestly answering questions about whether or not she had a bias. She was told the day before, which this judge forgot, that she should save her responses on bias until the next day. And then the next day, when it was time to talk about bias, she tried to talk about it. And she had excellent reasons for bias. She is somebody who treats children in hospitals. She said specifically that part of her job is treating people who were allegedly sexually abused. She didn't say allegedly. She'd seen it too much. She couldn't be fair. She had excellent reasons. And the judge snapped, as you saw on the video. The judge reacted to her in a way that in 15 years almost, as a public defender, I had never seen. And then after that, again, contrary to what was said in the state's brief, because these were misrepresentations in the brief, no one else would admit to bias. Not even juror number 333, who herself had been sexually abused as a child. She talked about the sexual abuse and how difficult it was, but then at the end, she wouldn't say that she had a bias. That is why this is structural constitutional error, because we were denied the opportunity to get a fair jury and to fully and fairly voir dire this jury on the issue of bias. It had a chilling effect, and that chilling effect requires reversal. In Parody versus Washoe, a judge's joking behavior, which may have adversely influenced the jury, was found to be structural constitutional error. This was no joke. it was deadly serious and it has to be treated as such. Now, in the event the court is not prepared to call this structural constitutional error, then the appropriate standard of review is harmless error review under Chapman, because it would be constitutional harmless error review. It's constitutional because it affected Mr. Azucena's constitutional right to a fair trial by an impartial jury, which implicates both the due process and jury trial rights under the federal and state constitutions. Now, under Chapman, as the court will recall, the state has the burden of proving that their error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. They cannot, and they did not in their brief. So either way, reversal is required. But I do encourage the court to find this a structural harm or structural error, because that's what it was in this circumstance. The judge's outburst in voir dire set the tone for the entire trial. The tone continued into the Allen charge. And it's one of the many factors, as you do a totality of the circumstances review on the Allen charge and whether or not it's coercive, it is one of the factors that has to be considered. Now, Nevada courts have long recognized, as have many other courts across the country, that Allen charges are fraught with difficulty. Justice Hardesty, I believe that in Malcolm Manning, during the argument, you made mention of the difficulty of Allen charges. In Robbins, Justice Silver said that the Supreme Court is, quote, reluctant to approve them, which is citing to other Nevada cases. While courts have found them generally constitutional, because of their coercive nature, there has to be a totality of the circumstances test on a case-by-case basis to see whether under these circumstances it was still constitutional. Well, under our circumstances, they absolutely were not. Again, as I said, the voir dire set the tone. The judge's outburst was completely unwarranted and unjustified. This was somebody who was just responding to a question and who had a very good and well-reasoned response. And she was shot down in a way that told the jury, if the response you give displeases me, not if it's right or wrong, if it displeases me, there will be repercussions. And he used the word repercussions. The jury got that message loud and clear. And it was reaffirmed over and over again with the court's subsequent outbursts against counsel, not just the defense. There were a few, at least one that I can think of, against the state as well. But, again, the message was, say something that displeases me, and I'm going to react. And the way he reacted was incredibly unprofessional. His conduct violated judicial conduct rules, and it violated the court's basic position, which is to, again, be a fair and unbiased arbiter. Then there was the note. The note really sets this case apart from any other case in which an approved Allen charge is given. Now, again, there's lots of cases where there was an unapproved Allen charge that was given that had language that wasn't approved. The language of the Allen charge in this case was part of the approved Allen charge language. But what really sets us apart is the note that came from the jury that led directly to the Allen charge. This note said, quote, we have one jury, should be juror, one jury that believes not guilty on all counts. What is our next step? Can you talk to him? If you break it down, what that note tells you is, first, it's 11-1 not guilty. Second, there is a single holdout voting not guilty on all counts. I think it was 39, all 39 counts. The other juries were exasperated enough to send that note. And the tone of the note is exasperated. What do we do about this guy? Will you talk to him? We also know it's a him, so we know some identity of the holdout. We know it's a male. The jury feels comfortable with the judge tattling on the holdout because they've learned throughout the entire trial if something makes a judge mad, the judge is going to do something about it. He's going to come down hard. The jury is confident the judge will force this holdout in line. And really, I can't think of anything more coercive than not just sending that note, but then having the judge respond to the note with an Allen charge. The judge started his Allen charge just to remove any doubt as to what the judge was doing here and whether or not he was talking to this one lone holdout. He started the Allen charge by reading the note to the entire jury. So you can't argue, well, maybe the one holdout didn't realize that this was directed at him, because he began by reading the note to the jury. This made it clear the Allen charge was in response to the note and that it was directed at the lone holdout. I mean, they said talk to this guy, and he talked to this guy.
So the fact that the court read the note and now the note disclosed the division between the jury, do you think an opinion regarding disclosure of the division prior to giving an Allen charge, taking from either the D.C. Circuit that you've cited to or the Ninth Circuit, would be helpful in this district?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Every single case that we found that considered the question of Allen charges, where the numerical division is known, has found them coercive.
And there's nothing in Nevada regarding this division?
There isn't an approved Allen charge. Now, the Ramsey case noted that there was an 11-1 not guilty and the division was known, but it wasn't an approved Allen charge, so it's not directly on point. I mean, that said, they noted, I think it was noted very clearly, that the 11-1, the knowledge of that was coercive. But there was also, you know, there was also unapproved language in the Allen charge itself. The Clark case also had unapproved language, but it was important to the court, and it was noted that it was coercive, that it was 11-1, and that the court knew what the division was. Now, in Sei Chua, which is probably not pronounced that way, the Ninth Circuit used an approved charge. There was an approved charge used by the lower court in that case, but the 11-1 division was huge. The same thing is true of Smith. This case is the worst because the judge knew he was coercing the lone holdout. He actually said, I've never had a case where the jurors collectively have said, go talk to this holdout. That's kind of unusual for me. He said that before talking to the holdout. And we told him that under federal law, you cannot give an Allen charge when there's an 11-1 division and you know the division. The jury knows you know it, and you know it. It's going to be coercive. It's going to require reversal, and that's what happened in this case. And it can't ever be harmless if that's the standard that the court intends to use.
Mr. Westbrook, I know you want to save some time, and I don't. Can you briefly address for me 51385 and whether the foundation that the judge laid for those statements?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's a lot of problems with 51.385 process that was used, from late disclosure to, you know, violating NRS 174.125 as far as notice for the hearing. But what it comes down to is several things. First of all, it created cumulative hearsay testimony. It was all piling on. What the judge did at the hearing was essentially give a blanket dispensation for all hearsay that comes from these witnesses without going through and doing what you are required to do under Felix versus State and the rest of the case law, the statute itself, which is go through, carefully analyze each one of the statements individually, and then tell us which ones are admitted and which ones are denied. I tried to ask him which ones to get a ruling, which ones are admitted and which ones are denied, and he just said everything. That is a blanket ruling. It absolutely violates statute and the Constitution. It made it so we couldn't possibly prepare on what was said. And then these witnesses were allowed to proceed outside of the 51.385 hearing completely. And that was also allowed. And our request for a curative instruction was denied. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Hannon.
May it please the court. With respect to what the trial judge did with respect to that judge, with that respective juror, what he did was inappropriate. The first analysis, though, is really what is the standard that we review this under? I know the appellants have asked that this be reviewed under a structural error, but that's the inappropriate standard. None of the cases that they've cited to in their briefs, when dealing with a juror who is being talked to during the voir dire process, was ever analyzed under a structural error analysis. If it's been preserved, it's harmless. If it's not, it's plain error. And when you examine under a harmless error review, it's clear that this is not a situation that ultimately affected the outcome in the case. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the appellant has repeatedly said that no one subsequent to the outburst ever spoke up about having a potential bias. And that's dispelled by the record. I would point to Appellant's Appendix 1089, pin site 4, going through appellant's appendix 1090. That's juror number 214. Defense counsel had gotten up at third portion and asked the following question. Is anyone sort of worried that they can't be fair? It was Ms. Kearney who made that statement. And juror number 214 stated, and I quote, I think I could be, but I mean, there's always that slight doubt in my head dealing with children. I mean, you never know for sure, but I think I could be. She followed up by saying, I really think I will be, but you know, there's always that when you're dealing with, you never know for sure, you start seeing it, keep crying, who knows what you're going to do. If, as appellant had stated, the trial judge outburst, which is inexcusable, it's not appropriate, chilled them, she wouldn't have done this. She would not have said that. But she did. And when you look at the timing of the situation under a harmless error analysis, and that's why this analysis about what standard we use is so important, you have to look at the timing of the situation. On day one was the time when the trial judge went through and asked anybody if they had any potential biases. And so it was on day one when the entire panel really shared thoughts and feelings about sexual abuse, thoughts and feelings about children, and it is correct. Juror number 177, you look in the transcript, she had laid out some concerns but then had indicated, but I'd like to maybe raise something at a later point. He didn't get to it. So it came out on day two. But when we start talking about substantially affecting the appellant's right, day one was when that whole panel shared their thoughts and feelings. And yes, there was an inappropriate outburst. But even after that fact, juror number 214 then starts to share once again, I've got concerns because of these children. And that is proof positive that that outburst did not have a chilling effect. I would point to the record when we examine what the defense did in their voir dire.
Can I ask you, counsel, I brought up with the appellant the issue of disclosure of the division of the jury prior to issuance of the Allen instruction. It appears that both the D.C. Circuit Court and the Ninth Circuit have reversed based on that one issue alone. And then you bring up Foster. I'd like you to explain that, because Foster is obviously from the Ninth Circuit as well. How do you distinguish Foster? Isn't this case and the fact of what the judge said, what the note read, and the division closer to, I won't say it right, Say Chua and Smith than it is Foster, as you've replied in your brief?
My position on that, Your Honor, is I think in terms of reading the instruction, I think the trial judge was simply trying to read the question out to make a record of it. I know that I don't believe there was any objection to having that instruction read out to the jury panel when it happened. I understand that that then gets probably reviewed under a plain error review. I think at the end of the day, I think he was attempting to simply reiterate what the question was and read the charge. One of the things that I noted, at least about the instruction, was they didn't say that they were hopelessly deadlocked. That's not actually what it said. It did state that one person believes not guilty on all charges. I think they said, what do we do? And I think that's significant because they didn't say necessarily that he wasn't willing to deliberate. They were not indicating that he's refusing to talk to us. They didn't indicate we're at a complete impasse. I think we're kind of hopelessly hung. None of those phrases were done. And I think part of that is due to the fact we don't know exactly why they're writing this. And part of this is this was essentially a two-week trial where they had only deliberated about 5 hours on 39 counts. And I think that's significant because when they raised this question and the judge then subsequently reads an Allen charge, they go back and deliberate for a few more hours, and then essentially they don't railroad whoever this prospective juror is. It's not a guilty verdict on all 39 counts.
Wasn't there some interplay that, boy, that one juror, I think it's number 6, I could be wrong on the number, boy, that guy is really ticked off and he's a ex-NFL hockey player, and there's some interaction between the prosecutor and the defense counsel in the hallway, and where the prosecutor, and I believe it was
I know what you're referring to, Your Honor, and the bottom line was, I've seen that multiple times. I don't think you can read anything into it, because that could have been someone who thought, listen, I think this guy is completely guilty on all 39 counts, and I don't want to be here any longer. I would love to be able to have this resolved. I guess presumably you could also hypothetically assume, well, maybe he's upset about it. Maybe he's the holdout. But what's clear in this record is we don't know why he was making that reaction. He could have wanted to go home. He could have felt that this was pretty clear. He could have been someone who disagreed. But we don't know, and I think it's inappropriate to speculate as to why he might have a reaction like that. Because you've had, I would say in my experience in speaking with juries in the past, you might have a juror having a reaction. They may be on both sides of the coin. And so I don't think that is sufficient to kind of tie in that particular person as being the lone holdout. And I don't think there's anything before this court in the record that would suggest he was reacting in that manner because he was the lone holdout and he felt he was being bullied. I think that's too speculative. But to get back to my point, I think what is interesting when you review the record is it's only about 5 hours of reviewing these charges. They kind of say, hey, what do? This instruction's read. It's an approved instruction. And then after several hours after that, they go back home, I think. They come back. They deliver freight for several hours more. They come back, and there is a compromise. So you had an instruction that indicated a lot of them felt guilty on everything. But now you've reached a compromise where there was some clear deliberation between those 12 people because there are 9 not guilty charges. And if that Allen charge was so coercive, why isn't it entirely 39 counts of straight guilty? I mean, if that's really what we're talking about. And I think what the Allen charge did, its practical effect, when you think about a 2-week trial, when you think about they had only deliberated on 39 counts for about 5 to 6 hours, the Allen charge served its purpose. It said to go back steadfastly, see if you guys can deliberate, to see if you guys can reach a compromise. And they did. So
why give an Allen charge at all? Is that, if, as you say, it's that early in the process, you're suggesting the note's ambiguous about even why they're sharing it. Why do you give an Allen charge with that information at that time in the deliberations, knowing that they're inherently coercive and problematic?
I would submit the reason was, at least at that point, there was a question of what do we do. And it's not necessarily that they're saying we're hopelessly deadlocked. They were just simply looking for some guidance. And I think one of the reasons why an Allen charge can be at least somewhat instructive about what do you do if maybe there is a difference of opinion in a jury is to just remind them, hey, see if you can kind of go back steadfastly and talk amongst yourselves. Keep to your convictions, but see if you guys can talk this out. And I admit, Your Honor, I don't remember who raised the request for the Allen charge. I think it may have been the trial judge, I think, at that point. I know the state's position simply was, I think it's a little too premature at this point after 5 hours to just declare a hung jury because that's not what the note is saying. And so that's really what the state's position was. The state believed that the note was not indicating we are hopelessly deadlocked. They were just asking for some type of guidance. And I think the court decided that ultimately an Allen charge could help maybe provide some guidance. And I think after deliberating for another several hours and you reached a compromise verdict, I think that jury got together and thoroughly talked out what they thought about the different charges. And what you didn't see there was an appellant who was essentially across the board, all 39 charges came down. That's not what happened. It included sexual assault charges. It included lewdness charges. It wasn't necessarily just the most insignificant charges of the group. It ran across the board, child abuse, lewdness, as well as sexual assault.
I want to turn to where the court states, so I think we can bypass the oath. The court is convinced that this witness will testify truthfully based on her responses and demeanor. So I'll allow the question to be asked. Before that, telling the child she was very pretty, and at the end of her testimony saying, you're a brave little girl. How do you respond to the accusation by the appellant that this is judicial misconduct? You have a case where credibility is at issue. You have no physical evidence. How is this not error that is reversible?
Well, with respect to his saying to bypass the formal oath, I believe that's in reference to the fact of her age, because I believe that particular child was bilingual and had difficulty kind of speaking kind of period. And so what they went for was a type of a line of questions evaluating her credibility, which was an alternative to the oath.
I'm talking about his statement. The court is convinced that this witness will testify truthfully. And that's coming out of the judge's mouth regarding that witness who is getting ready to testify. And that jury is watching that judge say that.
And I understand that. And I don't think the trial judge should have uttered the word in that context. I think he was trying to essentially say, I think she's credible based on my earlier questions. It may be in an artful way of using the word truthfully. But I would submit to you, with respect to this case, I don't think the case was rising and falling necessarily on that one particular child witness. This was a fairly unique case when we have child sexual assaults where you have five testifying victims. And what was interesting about the case is that multiple victims were present when other victims were being molested. And so I would submit to you, if this was a lone child who was testifying about being abused at the hands of the appellant, and the trial judge makes a statement of, you know, when trying to establish credibility, I think she's going to testify truthfully, that would be incredibly damaging to an appellant in terms of affecting the outcome of the case. But when you have a case where there are five children observing other children, and the jury had the ability to literally see if they were corroborating one another, and they're not all from the same family, they were from three separate different families, I think while it's an error, I think it's harmless. And that would be my response with respect to that, given the nature of the case, given the number of victims that you had in this case, and given the fact that all five victims were repeatedly present while other ones were being sexually abused and molested.
We've talked about a couple of what have been alleged errors by the appellant. What about their accusation that all of these errors add up to, albeit harmless, cumulative? What's your response?
My response to that is, this is, in my years of being on the Special Victims Unit, I'm not there anymore, I have never had a case with this many children. And it was very unique, because typically when I have tried these cases, it is one child's word against another. And that is really not what you had in this case. You had five different children all testifying about these different experiences. And they were consistent. And that was what was very compelling about it. Because I agree with you, the outburst from the trial judge never should have happened. The unlawful use of the word truthfully never should have happened. But I would submit to your honors that when the jury listened to child after child after child talking about things like, he would touch me over my clothes, he would offer me candies, he would put Kit Kats in his pants and ask that we reach them out, and you're hearing that from multiple kids saying, and I watched her do it, and someone say, I chose not to do that, and they talked about the threats, because that was another consistent thing. They'd say, he said if we would tell anyone, they would kill my family, which prompted them to go to the neighbor. When you have multiple kids all saying that, that is a lot of corroborative evidence that is atypical for a child sexual abuse case.
Mr. Hamner, I think the state is in an awkward position in this case because of the behavior of the trial judge. My concern, that I'd like you to offer your view, does the collective behavior of the trial judge in this case undermine confidence in the judicial system, which goes to the heart, really, of the argument that one should look at the behavior as structural error? Believe me, nothing is more painful for your office, I'm sure, and it certainly is painful to judges to reverse a trial conviction where it's caused from outside influences, juror misconduct or judicial misconduct. You begin to get away from the merits of the issue, and you sure as heck don't want to put children through this or the defendant through this because somebody has behaved inappropriately. But we have said, in the context of structural error, behavior impairs confidence in the judicial system. And I think viewing the tape and reading the transcript, this behavior is so outrageous that it raises that specter. Do you have some observations about that? Because that is an issue we've talked about before.
And I understand. And I would submit to the court on this issue. When you examine the line of cases that have been carved out to deal with structural error, you were talking about things like Batson challenges. You're talking about depriving someone of their right to counsel. You are depriving the right of a public trial. These are very, very significant things. And the reality is, in this case, and in my experience, listen, there are times where trial judges make comments. Sometimes they're appropriate, sometimes they're inappropriate. And there is no litmus test from anything in our jurisprudence or in any of the other circuits that would stretch as far as to say when judges start making comments, whether it's in voir dire or some other portion, we should automatically find that a structural error, because I think that's a dangerous road that you travel down. I think the appropriate standard is harmless error, and I think because a comment can be made at any point in time in the trial, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it affects the entire function of the trial itself. And so I would submit to you, I don't believe structural error is the appropriate standard, because I think that is a dangerous
path. So let's say that
there's
we
no
agree with
test
you
for.
That, I okay. put it this way, not all misconduct is the same.
Sure.
There's acts of misconduct that might not influence the trial or the fair trial rights of the defendant. So a structural error rule might be an overstatement, but that said, there is some misconduct that's so egregious, reviewed on a case-by-case basis, that it really does raises a question about the confidence that the public has in the criminal justice system. Does this conduct reach that level?
I would answer it twofold. I think when we're evaluating this under a harmless error and a cumulative error standard, it is imperative that you review the record. The state's position is you review the record when you listen to what those child witnesses had to say.
Yeah.
Because when you do, it's clear why the verdict was the way it was. That doesn't mean that there isn't room to reprimand this judge for his behavior. But when we're coming down to an analysis of really was that particular outburst or these two or three outbursts the real reason why this jury found that man guilty of molesting these five kids, I think the answer is a resounding no. And I think the record is very clear as to that, because there was so much corroboration, there was so much detail, there was corroboration about the events. And so I think an opinion has enough room to address what the trial judge did, but at the same time acknowledge the significant and the extensive amount of corroborative evidence of five separate victims.
Well, I wanted to add one other thing, since counsel are here. What I was also disturbed with, and I think to counsel's efforts, all counsel in the case seemed to try to approach the bench to discuss with the trial judge what was taking place, and he wouldn't permit you to do so. So I want to commend counsel for, during the course of the trial, trying to get a grip on all of this and raising the seriousness of this problem, and I thank counsel for trying to do that. It's unfortunate that the trial judge didn't allow you to even approach the bench.
Thank you very much.
I do think, Justice Stiglitz, and maybe you want to pose this question, but I would like to hear you on 5385.
Counsel, if I can target it just
sure,
a little bit
yeah.
more. Obviously, corroboration in this context is very powerful evidence, and it's not clear to me from the record that the judge is discharging his duty in this context under 51385 about reliability. Spontaneity is the first piece. Where in this record would I find that the judge made an independent evaluation of each of these witnesses, each of these statements? And we get the spontaneity. He had statements coming in under a forensic examiner. I can't think of something less spontaneous than a child getting sent off with a detective or with a forensic examiner to answer questions. I'm troubled by that.
I would turn the court's attention to the appellate's appendix at 1394 through 1399.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what the trial judge did at that point was he actually tried to walk through and did walk through the spontaneity, subject to repetitive questions, motives to fabricate, use of unexpected terminology. And he kind of goes through those factors and works in those different children at different times with respect to whether it was respect to the neighbor or maybe when they were disclosing to a parent, as well as a forensic interviewer. So I would turn to that area. I don't believe the court just kind of willy-nilly said, I think they're all reliable, we're done here. The transcript devotes about 5 to 6 pages to him kind of walking through those factors, and he was reading out the factors and going through and explaining.
Based on what offer of proof? I mean, did he take any evidence outside of those pages? Were those witnesses brought forward to lay a foundation for that testimony, for spontaneity, for those other pieces?
Absolutely. So the forensic interviewer testified during this all-day hearing about what happened, how the interview went, was subject to cross-examination. The neighbor, when the children came to them the night before they told their parents, she also testified about what their demeanor was like, who came first, who came next, what was going on, what she was observing, and what they were relaying. And she was subject to cross-examination. The mother of 3 of the children also testified, and she also explained what happened the following day when the children came to them in a panic because they were worried that he was going to take them off to a Chuck E. Cheese, and they got very upset. So when we're dealing with things like spontaneity, particularly with the neighbor and the parents, these children are just disclosing in a very spontaneous way, and that's coming out during this 51-385 hearing and being subject to cross-examination. You also had the parents of the 5th girl, as well as Ms. Estrella. She was the parent of another. They both testified also. Ms. Estrella and Ms. Moisa, they were the ones who were there when 4 of the children came, subject to meeting the Cuban neighbor and kind of in a panic or saying, hey, look, please don't let us go away with this guy. Here's what's been going on. The last father of the last child, he testified, and his testimony essentially was how he discovered it by talking to the parents, and then he disclosed when he sat down with his daughter saying, hey, did anything ever happen when you were over with the appellant? And she kind of shared it, and that was also subject to cross-examination. So during this hearing, the judge did have an opportunity to listen to all the people that ultimately testified at the jury trial and evaluate these different factors. And so I do believe there's a record of that. It's obviously prior to the 1394 reference, but it was a fairly lengthy trial where directs and cross-examinations happen with these witnesses.
We've asked you a lot of questions, Mr. Hammer. Are there any other questions from the panel?
Well, listen, I thank you for your
thank
time.
Thank you very much
thank you.
For your argument. We asked a lot of questions. Time went over. Mr. Westbrook, you'll have an additional 4 minutes to conclude your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I, too, appreciate you commending us on trying to improve the record. The fact of the matter is we're all experienced trial lawyers, and we all knew exactly what was happening, both the state and the defense. We knew that what was happening was that reversible error was being injected by this judge throughout the trial, and we tried to stop it, and he simply wouldn't let us. And that's why this case has to be reversed. I mean, a simple reprimand is not going to be enough. This case has to be reversed, and we have to do it all over again because the right to a fair trial was destroyed by this judge's actions, and that's just a fact. Regarding 51.385, the judge literally said, all child witnesses are likely telling the truth. Volume 7, 1398. That is as blanket as it gets. He figured if it was coming out of a child's mouth, then it was the truth. That's how he acted throughout the trial. He literally told the jury, I believe this witness is telling the truth, which couldn't have been worse in a case which relies entirely on testimony for which there was no physical evidence. Whether or not these witnesses are telling the truth was the only issue in this case. And he started out the trial by saying, I believe she's going to tell the truth. I mean, at that point, it was basically over, if it wasn't already over from the outburst with juror number 177. I take issue with the idea that these witnesses were all consistent. They were anything but consistent. The stories changed. I think there's a quote in there from one of the children's mother who said, day after day, my girls kept coming up to me with new facts and new facts and new facts every day. Something like that, I'm paraphrasing.
And that was happening. It even happened after the 51.385 hearing when we heard brand new allegations in the middle of trial. They were not consistent. There were some elements that were consistent, but they were inconsistent with their own prior statements, and they were inconsistent with each other. And when they were interviewed by people like Usne, the neighbor, they were interviewed in a group setting where they were all talking and telling their stories at the same time. They were not particularly reliable, and they absolutely were not consistent.
They were interviewed in a group setting where?
The first person to interview them was Usne, the neighbor from Cuba. And the way she interviewed them was all the kids in her living room all telling her stories all at once. And she was frankly so unfamiliar with the children that she kept forgetting their names. Like she couldn't tell the twins apart and she couldn't remember who said what. And yet she was allowed, which is another violation of 51.385, to go in and testify as to what some kids said about things that allegedly happened to other kids, which is a direct violation. So it's not reliable, and this is testimony that was done in a group setting in a way that could never be considered reliable. So this blanket ruling that I think the kids are telling the truth was incredibly damaging and requires reversal. Under Weaver and Gomez, this should certainly be structural. When there's a judge talking to a jury during voir dire, there are cases on point that can be structural. We have one in this jurisdiction. It's Baral, where there was a judge who failed to give the instruction to the jury, and that was reversed as structural constitutional error. This is not the factually the same thing, but spiritually it certainly is. We're talking about the fundamental right to have a fair jury and to be able to fairly voir dire the jury, which was destroyed by this outburst with juror number 177, an outburst which, again, I literally interrupted in the middle of and tried to stop and was unable to. The jury was not just saying, can you help us out here, judge, what do we do next? The jury literally and specifically said, this one guy wants not guilty on all counts, what do we do? They were calling out a single juror in their note. The judge recognized that verbally as calling out a single juror in a note, said, that's weird, I've never seen that happen before, and then acted exactly as the jury asked him to, which was, would you talk to this guy? In every jurisdiction that we've reviewed this issue in, and certainly in the Ninth Circuit, Your Honor, certainly in the Ninth Circuit, his case would be overturned on that alone. Because he absolutely knew the numerical division. The jury knew that he knew the numerical division. And in our case, which is egregious even by the other cases' standards, it's more egregious than the Ninth Circuit cases, more egregious than the D.C. Court of Appeals case. And the judge informed them what he was doing. I'm talking to this one juror. And then he did it. I mean, he read their note back to them just so there would be no error whatsoever. Everybody would be clear, I'm talking to this one juror. I mean, this is the most egregious case that I came across that involves the properly worded Allen charge. So it just has to be reversed based on that, and there's no question in the Ninth Circuit that it would be. There were only, and this is actually a record that Mr. Hamner made, volume 15, 29-14, there were only 2.5 hours of deliberation after the Allen charge. That's Mr. Hamner's record on that page. So it was a very short period of time after the Allen charge that this one holdout juror capitulated. And the fact that juror number 6 was so angry and that he was observed, and the only record we have is my record. I'm the only one who made a record on it. I observed him, which is in the record, angrily discussing the case with the jury foreman, juror number 11, talking back and forth in a very animated, very angry tone. That happened in front of all of us. It's part of the record and has to be considered when you're dealing with the totality of circumstances test. That's what happened, and that's what that poor holdout juror was dealing with in the jury room. We got a glimpse of it. It just happened to happen in court where we can make a record about it, and that's the record that we have. You can't just discount it.
Sir, were the nine acquittals. Anything about those charges?
About the nine acquittals?
Yeah.
I don't have anything specific about the nine acquittals, but I do want to point out as well, when you're talking about the effect of this instruction on the jury, that they convicted of child abuse and neglect charges for which there is no evidence, for reasons that were described in great detail inside the brief. He has no legal responsibility for the children, among other things. They also convicted on counts 25 and 26, which by the state's own admission requires reversal, because they were in the alternative. So it has to be reversed on that. Yet they convicted on everything because the effect of the court was so overwhelming that that's what they felt they had to do. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Westbrook.